Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Donald Trump's campaign and questions about his fundraising plans are creating challenges for other Republican candidates. With me in the studio to talk about what this could mean for the GOP's get-out-the-vote operations and control of the House and Senate, Stuart Rothenberg of the Rothenberg and Gonzalez Political Report, Mattia Gold with The Washington Post, and Josh Krasauer with National Journal. Thank you all for being with us today.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
We're going to invite our listeners to join our conversation a little later in the hour. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email, drshow@wamu.org, or leave us a message on Facebook or Twitter. Well, Mattia, you had a big scoop in yesterday's Washington Post about Donald Trump's fundraising plans. What did you find?
So what's very interesting is that top Trump fundraisers said that they don't have a formal fundraising schedule to bring in large dollar donations for the remaining weeks of the campaign. And this is in sharp contrast to not only what Romney's campaign did in 2012 when he deployed his wife and sons and members of Congress to continue raising money for the party in the final weeks before Election Day, but also even more relevant to this moment is a sharp contrast with what Secretary Clinton's campaign is doing. We counted 41 events up until November 3rd that are being headlined by top surrogates, including Cher, which means that there's going to be a huge flow of cash going to the Democratic Party in these final critical days.
So it's 41 Democratic events, and so far as you know, zero Trump campaign events.
Well, since our story published, the Trump campaign has said they have a handful of events scheduled, and it sounds like they're going to do some ad hoc events, as they said. And they maintain they're still raising money for the party through online donations, a share of which goes to the RNC, and also through phone calls with major donors looking to bring in funds in these final weeks. But what's really important here is not just what they're not doing in these final weeks, but the fact that from the beginning of this election cycle, Hillary Clinton has made an aggressive effort to bring in large donations for the party. This is an advantage that she had set from the very beginning of this race, and it's paying off for her now.
Not only has she raised a lot of money, Stu, but she's had a big get-out-the-vote operation, and the Trump campaign has sort of subcontracted that. What are they doing? Right.
You know, this is more of the same if you think about it over the last 6, 9 months, the last 15 months that Trump has been in the race. He really hasn't done much for the party. He didn't have a ground game for himself. He didn't spend money on those traditional campaign events and organizations. And so I think it follows. Donald Trump is his own campaign manager, his own political party, his own person, and he doesn't do much for the campaign. Hillary Clinton understands the nature of modern campaigns, which goes anything from raising high dollar and low dollar amounts of money to organization, to putting in offices in individual states and individual districts. So we have a fundamentally different approach to politics with Donald Trump versus everybody else in the universe.
And Josh, I saw the U.S. Election Project, which is tracking voting in a serious way, it's reported yesterday that more than 10 million people already have voted. Is that unusual? Is that number higher than before?
It suggests we may have a healthier than expected turnout. A lot of people are actually voting against their candidate, against their favorite candidate, rather than for Trump or Clinton. But it also suggests that Democrats are doing a very good job. They're using the money to very good effect to turn out early voters. You look at North Carolina and Florida, two of the biggest battleground states, two states that Donald Trump absolutely needs to win if he holds any chance of winning the presidency. And you look at the early voting data this year compared to 2012, and Democrats are overachieving their expectations. They're turning out a lot of the voters that don't turn out quite as often for midterm elections. They're turning out base voters. So the money that the Clinton organization is pouring into to the ground game and the get out the vote efforts looks like it's paying off in these key battlegrounds.
You know, we have a poll in today's paper, a national poll that USA Today did with Suffolk University that shows that a majority of Americans are worried about violence on Election Day. 51% think there's at least some chance of violence on Election Day. And I wonder if that is fueling some early voting because people just want to be in a position not to have to go to their polling places.
There's some states have actually curtailed the number of polling places that you're allowed to vote, and there have been anecdotal evidence of long lines in states like North Carolina because of that. But look, I think there was a story in Bloomberg that came out today suggesting that the Trump campaign strategy is to really tamp down on the base Democratic voting by trying to, you know, have targeted messages to African Americans, reminding them of some of the Clinton rhetoric in the 90s, and trying to turn out among young voters who may have just been aware of the Clinton scandals of the 90s as well. I don't know if that'll be effective, but that's certainly their strategy is now openly not to win over the persuadables. It's to tamp down turnout among key Democratic groups.
That absolutely makes sense, because when you look at the survey data on these presidential ballot tests, you see that Trump is stuck pretty much between 37% and 40% of the vote.
Not a winning number.
No. But you suppress Democratic votes. You either suggest intimidation or cross-pressure those voters, and, you know, then maybe Donald Trump has a chance. So that would make sense.
So we know Donald Trump has some trouble in national polls. In battleground states, maybe it's slightly closer than the national numbers. But when you look at down-ballot races, Mateo, when you look at Senate races, House races, governor's races, how much difference does it make whether Trump is funding get-out-the-vote efforts? Does it affect people down the ballot?
Well, sure. And it's actually not just Trump. It's the Republican Party. Traditionally, the Republican Party has relied on the nominee to help bring in the funding for a national voter mobilization effort that helps the entire ticket. Usually that's supplemented by the presidential nominee. Romney had hundreds of staffers doing fieldwork on the ground in concurrence with RNC field organizers. Trump had 168 paid staffers on payroll at the end of September, according to the last FEC filing, while Clinton had 815. So you can see in those numbers how much he's really outsourced this function to the RNC. And they argue they are in much better place than they were in 2012 when they acknowledged they were really beat in the field game by the Democrats. But they need every resource they can get because their incumbents particularly are locked in some very tough re-election battles.
You know, Josh, it's not just get out the vote efforts. You look at some of these key Senate races in places like Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, where Hillary Clinton, the polls show, has a pretty healthy lead, not a double-digit lead, but she's at 7, 8, 9 points in the latest statewide polls. How hard is it for a Republican Senate candidate like Pat Toomey or Kelly Ayotte to make up that ground?
Historically, at least in recent history, it's been very hard. As people tend to cast more party line ballots, it's harder to have distance from the presidential nominee, though this year may be the exception because Donald Trump is such an unusual Republican candidate. And if you look at the national polls, Trump gets about 80% of the Republican vote, whereas congressional candidates, Republicans, get about 90% or more of the partisan vote. And you can see that. You look at some of the generic ballot tests saying which party would voters rather have in power in Congress, and you're pretty close to an even ballot. Democrats have a 1-point advantage in the ABC tracking poll that came out yesterday, a 2-point advantage in the Fox poll that came out yesterday. So we really could see a pretty high level of split ticket voting. The big worry, though, that Republicans have is that turnout among college-educated, anti-Trump Republicans, that people may just be so disgusted with this whole election, they may not show up, and that would be a big drag on the Republican Party.
Stu, how hard is it to get people in this day and age when things are so polarized to split their ticket?
Well, it's an added burden that Kelly Ayotte doesn't want to have and Pat Toomey doesn't want to have, and even Richard Burr now in North Carolina doesn't want to have. You'd much rather have the top of the ticket winning, and you just need to hold that vote or hold most of it to win. But I'm still a little uncertain how this is going to work out, I must admit, because if you think 4 years ago, you know, Heidi Heitkamp ran way ahead of Barack Obama in North Dakota. She won very, very narrowly over Berg. What was his name?
Berg, yeah.
How quickly you forget.
Yeah. Richard Berg? No, I don't know. Richard Berg. Over Berg. And so in a presidential year, I always remind people, voters have two ballots, a ballot for president and a ballot for Senate or Congress. In these midterm elections, where you tend to have more wave elections because you don't have a presidential ballot, the only way you can express your opinion about president is in the Senate race or the House race. So it is possible to have some of these Republicans running well ahead of the presidential nominee. But if you ask Kelly Ayotte, or you ask Republican insiders who are close to that campaign or watching that campaign, they'll say, "Well, look, if Kelly Ayotte's losing, if Donald Trump is losing in New Hampshire by 3, 4, 5 points, absolutely Kelly Ayotte can win. But if Trump is losing by 10 or 12 points, it's a whole different ballgame."
One thing that I think is so unpredictable right now is to try to assess the down ballot impact of candidates who had been supporting Trump and then backed away from him, because they are now feeling the pinch on both sides when they were continuing to stand by him amid a lot of controversial comments and episodes that were surfacing from his past. They were getting beat up by Democrats, and moderate Republicans were uncomfortable with their stance. Some of them who have now backed away are getting the heat from Republicans who are saying, you're betraying our nominee. And so, you know, the party was saying yesterday, was telling reporters they're doing predictive modeling to try to figure out where voters are going and who's turned out. And in this environment, I think it's very hard to know who those voters are casting ballots for.
So Jason Chaffetz, a prominent Republican member of the House, said after the disclosures or the allegations of sexual misconduct, it was outrageous. The language that Donald Trump used in that Access Hollywood video, outrageous. He couldn't possibly vote for him. And yesterday he announced that, well, he wasn't going to endorse him, but he was going to cast a ballot for him. That may risk disturbing everybody, not just people on one side. Well, we're going to take a short break. And then we're going to ask Stu Rothenberg what it is he wants to say. We're going to take your calls in a bit, too. 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio, Matea Gold. She's a reporter covering money and politics for The Washington Post. Josh Kraushauer, he's a political editor for The National Journal. And Stu Rothenberg, he is the founding editor of the Rothenberg and Gonzalez Political Report. And Stu, you were trying to get in right before the break. What did you want to
Susan,
say?
Well, Susan, I was just going to say that Joe Heck, Republican Senate nominee out in Nevada, is the poster child for this issue, this problem. We don't know how it's going to be resolved, of a candidate who endorsed Donald Trump and then unendorsed Donald Trump. It's a particular problem, not only because of the way he did it, but now Nevada appears to be in play. And so is it going to be close? Is Trump going to win it? Has Heck alienated those Trump voters? It's a fascinating question.
So the Democrats need to pick up only 4 Senate seats if Hillary Clinton wins the White House to take control away from the Republican Party. Josh, will they do that?
They are favored to do that, but it's by no means guaranteed. I mean, the biggest advantage Democrats have is that they have a lot of opportunities. So the map was always favorable for them at the beginning of this year, and you have as many as 6 or 7 races that are within the margin of error that are trending a little bit in the Democratic direction. So they would just need about, I guess, two. If Hillary Clinton wins the White House, they only need 2 of those 6 to take the majority.
Because there are 2 that we think are going to flip in
Illinois, Mark Kirk's seat, and also Ron Johnson in Wisconsin are favorable to the Democrats. It'll be hard to see Republicans holding those seats. So the Democrats really just need 2 of 6, and they also need to hold the Nevada seat, which is Harry Reid's seat that is also very competitive.
Matea.
And I think one thing that's been so fascinating is that the financial resources in this final run in the battle over control of the Senate have actually moved to the Democrats' favor in some manners. My colleague Paul Kane had a smart story about this that just posted on our website, which is that the Republicans invested very early in trying to protect their Senate incumbents from a Trump wave and a Trump ripple effect, whatever you want to call it, to the point where they have very little cash on hand left to protect these Republican candidates at a time when they are now being buffeted by all of these back and forth wins that we've been describing. Do you support Trump? Do you walk away from him? The Democratic Senate Committee and Democratic campaigns are in much better financial shape. And now really it's the Senate Republican super PAC that is rushing to the rescue. They're plowing $25 million into 6 Senate races in these final weeks, which is a huge amount of money. And also they're paying a massive premium. They are not getting very good pennies on the dollar because they're buying so late. And so this is really turning it into a dogfight on the airwaves.
Buying late, and also candidates' campaigns get the lowest possible rate when they buy TV ads. That's not the case with these super PACs. Paul Kane's story talks about a very totally different strategies that the two parties had when it came to spending early or spending late. What's the reasoning?
Well, I think that the rationale from the GOP's point of view was we need to get in there and build a firewall early. And I think you could argue that was a very smart and smart strategy at the point where they were in the race. I mean, they went in and, for example, put in a huge amount of money around Rob Portman in Ohio to the point which Democrats sort of cried mercy and backed away. But, you know, they're now having to put millions more back into Pennsylvania for Toomey. We're seeing money going to Missouri, which was a race they did not anticipate to play in. Obviously, New Hampshire is going to be one of the most expensive races at the end of this. So I think no one really anticipated how competitive this would be until the final days.
So Josh says it's possible but not guaranteed that that Republicans lose control of the Senate. What do you think?
Yes, I mean, this is one of those years where, you know, you look at the polls and you see the path obviously favors the Democrats. But I mean, who knows? I mean, there I think, a lot of unpredictable factors in each state that are hard to calculate.
I was talking to a Republican political consultant about the spending issue, and he said to me, you know, you can criticize the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee. I think they officially changed their name to NRSC, for not raising enough money, but you can't criticize them for making the decision they did about early spending. And when you look at a race like Richard Burr in North Carolina, he is very specifically getting some criticism for not engaging his opponent, Deborah Ross, the Democratic challenger, early on, and as Republicans like to say, taking her head off early on. And instead, she made the race about him. He was slow to respond. So you have to, I mean, it really isn't a question of do you go in early or do you go in late. You have to go in both. You have to raise enough money to do both, and you have to be prepared to go in early. Were you going to ask me where I thought the Senate was?
I was going to ask you that. But you're usually pretty shy about making predictions. What do you think?
I predict? No, you're right. I am. But I agree with my colleagues here that when you look at the number of races up, you have to say that it's more likely than not that the Democrats will take over the Senate, absolutely, that they'll win somewhere between 4 and 6 seats. Could we have a, from the Republicans' point of view, a pleasant surprise and the Republicans only lose 3 seats? Yeah, I wouldn't rule it out, but I think that's less likely than Republicans losing 4, 5, or 6 seats.
So Ohio's Senate race has been a surprise because at this point, Rob Portman, the Republican incumbent, seems to be in very good shape against a pretty significant Democratic challenger, Ted Strickland. Florida has been a little bit of a surprise too. Josh, tell us what's happening there, because Democrats are now seem to be backing away from that Senate race against Marco Rubio.
Candidates matter. And even though we talk about the grand macro political environment, I mean, if you have a bad candidate in a big, expensive Senate race, it makes a big difference. And Ted Strickland, because of his age, because of his record as an ousted governor when he lost to John Kasich, and frankly, just because of a poorly run campaign, Portman ran a great campaign. He spent money early, as Stu was talking about, and he really defined the race on his own terms. In Florida, you have a similar dynamic where you have a little known congressman who has some personal baggage, misrepresenting his resume.
Patrick Murphy,
the Democrat. And Democrats have been very wary about spending the $10, $20 million it would take to really compete in Florida on behalf of a candidate who has, you know, who isn't your top tier candidate, isn't one of the strongest candidates they have in their lineup. So, you know, they've really had to figure out where to pour. Democrats have had to figure out where to pour their resources, and they've looked at redder states like Missouri, North Carolina, Indiana, where Evan Bayh is running, instead of some of the more traditional battlegrounds because of the quality of their candidates.
Well, Indiana is another state that's been a surprise because we thought it was Republican-leaning. Evan Bayh, who used to be in the Senate from Indiana, got in. We thought that meant he would be in a very strong position. But now it looks very competitive. Mateo, tell us what's happening there.
I think Indiana at the end of this race is going to be looked at as the money pit of 2016 because it attracted millions of dollars on both sides in an effort by the Democrats to take back that seat. They had Evan Bayh coming out of retirement, and this was their white horse who was going to win back this seat. He came back in, though, with quite a lot of baggage, including questions about whether he had indeed been a lobbyist, you know, his residency in the state versus his time here in Washington. And Republicans still feel very confident that they're going to keep that seat. But what it has done is forced both the GOP and the Democrats to plow millions of dollars into a race that might end up basically a draw.
And it leaves you with the impression that Evan Bayh didn't plan to get back into politics because he didn't do some basic things like maintain a residence and go stay there in the state.
Apparently, Indiana political figures have an issue with that, that they don't seem to understand that voters in Indiana think it might be nice that their legislators actually live in Indiana.
Richard Lugar got caught
right,
in that, too.
Right, right. Yes. This is But you mentioned two races in a row, Florida and Indiana, that are really interesting because they have changed over the months. I remember one of my many mistakes when the talk about Marco Rubio running for the Senate after getting out of the presidential. I thought, well, that's a crazy idea. He turned his back on the state to run nationally, and then suddenly at the last minute he's going to look to save the seat. It looks like political ambition and nothing but transparent political decisions. And
pretty shocking.
It's going to be
a politician is acting in a political way.
the Republican Party, he fared poorly in the primary down there. And I talked to somebody afterward who said, no, when he went back to Florida, his Republican numbers were terrific. Republicans really liked him. It was simply a case that they liked Donald Trump better. In Indiana, I think I got it right in that I wrote a post column right after Evan Bayh got in saying, this didn't smell right to me. This was a guy who comes in at the last minute. How much money did he have in his personal account? Didn't he have like 15?
Yeah, 20,
that he was just holding on to.
Right. And so here he was going to come in to save the seats, to save the state. And it just struck me as this is Dick Lugar all over again, somebody who the voters like the way they remember him.
Right.
But they don't remember him how he is now. And so that's exactly what happened. So some of these races, they started off close and they stayed close, right? Toomey or Kelly Ayotte or something. And some of these races are fundamentally transformed during the 6 or 9 months or 10 months of the campaign.
So candidates matter, campaigns matter. You know, the Missouri Senate race is a big surprise to me. Didn't think Roy Blunt was going to be in any trouble. He's in the fight of his life now.
Yeah, in this anti-establishment, anti-insider political environment, being a lobbyist, being someone who's cashed in on public service, as Hillary Clinton was finding out in this presidential campaign, is a big liability. And Roy Blunt, in a pretty red state like Missouri, he also didn't know where his home was in Missouri. I think he also got grilled on that question and had a trouble answering it. And
you should have the address in your head.
That should be like the number one thing.
You ask me my address, I'm going to be able to tell you.
Politics 101, right? he's neck and neck against a very talented Democratic challenger, the Secretary of State, Jason Kander. So candidates matter. And if you're an insider, if you're someone who has gone Washington and hasn't really paid attention to your constituents back home, it's a drag on your campaign. And Blunt is finding that out in Missouri as well.
Let's go to the phones and talk to George. He's calling us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, one of those swing states with one of those swing Senate races. But I think he wants to talk about something else. George, hi, you're on the air.
But actually,
George,
Rubio,
hi, you're on
and
the...
his opponent just debated last night, and I think his opponent won, the Democratic opponent won. But what I want to talk about is the panelists talked about the lawmakers who, in fact, have... who initially endorsed Trump and later unendorsed him. But what about the Chaffetz, for instance, who unendorsed him after that very salacious video and now has re-endorsed him as of last evening? Could you talk about that?
Sure. George, now, are you going to vote in Florida?
Of course I'm going to vote, and I have no problem in voting for Hillary Clinton, although I really have issues with her. But given the choices we have, regrettably, there's very little choice.
And who are you going to vote for?
I do have very serious issues about her, but my main choice was Bernie Sanders. Of course, he didn't win primary, but of course, given the choice and given all of the horrible things that have come out of the mouth of Trump, you pretty much have no choice in this case.
And are you going to vote for the Democrat Patrick Murphy in the Senate race there?
I will vote for Patrick Murphy, no question. I never did like Rubio anyway. I'm an independent, but I never was a fan of Rubio anyway.
George, thank you so much for your call. You know, George's real question was about Jason Chaffetz. He's only one of several candidates, Republicans, who have found themselves trying to walk a really delicate line when it comes to what they say, think about Donald Trump. Tell us about some of the others who have had this problem and are having to deal with it.
Well, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire is a prime example. She made a slip in a debate and said she thought that Trump would be a good role model. Apparently, that did not go over well, and she then walked away from it. And you know, she and Chafis sort of represent the what happens when you try to walk on this very narrow balance beam, which is you can often fall off, right? And so Chafis last night we saw said he's not endorsing Trump, but he's voting for him, which of course brought no small amount of disparagement.
I saw
and mockery.
A tweet this morning that said that's like saying, I'm not going to write a reference for this guy to be, but I'm going to hire him.
Right.
But Josh, you were just in New Hampshire. What struck you while you were there?
Well, first of all, the flip flop is worse than being for Trump in the first place. If you're a Republican, and I was in New Hampshire, and I've been covering that race pretty extensively. What the Ayotte campaign found after she withdrew her support for Trump after the video came out, she said she's now writing in Mike Pence for president. Her numbers plummeted among Trump supporters. They said they can't support her for president. And then they've rebounded since then. But this is what Republicans across the board are finding. You can't win. You can't lose. You basically, if you say you're not going to support Trump, you're going to really lose a lot of support among the Republican base.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls 1-800-433-8850. Well, Matteo, let's take a step back. Why does it matter who controls the Senate? Does it matter much if Hillary Clinton wins the White House? How much does it matter that whether Democrats take it back control or not?
Well, I think you just ask President Obama that and see how he has been stymied in terms of the agenda that he's largely tried to push through. And, from Clinton's point of view, they are trying to get not only a mandate, but the political muscle to get through an agenda that she hopes will be sort of the signature piece of her administration. And we have seen this incredible gridlock here in this town with a divided political structure. And, you know, I think that the Republicans are arguing that they need to be a check on a Clinton administration, which sort of gives you a sign into their thinking about which way the presidential race is going to go. So they obviously want to hold on control and stop her from pushing through a lot of these programs. But I think if she comes in with a Senate in her control, not only are her appointments going to be able to go through, but she's also going to be able to have a lot more leverage when it comes to legislation.
Her appointments, say, to cabinet posts, her appointments to the Supreme Court. Also, the question of investigations. With Republican control, you are more likely to have investigations, aren't you, Stu?
Yeah, sure. But you're going to have that with the Republican House. There's probably a Republican House, and they're already planning, I'm sure, a series of investigations into various aspects of the Clinton universe. I'm going to tell you, certainly right. It's just more helpful to have a majority. When you have the majority leader, you can decide more in terms of the kind of ebb and flow of legislation and what's discussed and when it's discussed. But the Senate, in most cases, you need a supermajority. And so the larger the Democratic majority, assuming there's one, the better for the Democrats. But the Republicans won't be irrelevant. We have all witnessed situations where the minority party in the Senate was cohesive enough, polarized enough, defensive enough that even though there were only 46 or 47 Republicans, they were able to stop a lot of the Democratic initiatives.
Well, you know, we have a tweet from Ray who I'd sent a tweet out saying, is the House at risk, Republican control of the House? And he says, no, the GOP House is not at risk. And he attaches a map of the latest Cook Political Report House forecast, which is of 10 to 20 seats flipping to Democrats. That's not enough. They need 30. Is it possible that they'll get to 30, Josh?
There's an outside chance, but I'm very skeptical. And I think the Cook Report ratings really demonstrate why it's so challenging for Democrats. First of all, they didn't recruit the strongest candidates in all these suburban districts, these winnable seats. Where suburban Philadelphia is a great example, where there are two seats that lean a little bit Republican but are very winnable if there's an anti-Trump wave. And the Democrats didn't land candidates in either district, and they're not spending money in those two districts. So those are two missed opportunities. There are other examples across the map. And you also see in some of these specific races that are being contested, Republicans are gaining ground in some districts, Democrats are gaining ground in other districts. There's no wave-like atmosphere that seems to be taking place on the ground at this point.
That's Josh Krashauer. I'm sorry, Josh Krashauer. He's a political editor for the National Journal. Matea Gold's also with us. She covers money and politics for the Washington Post. And Stu Rothenberg from the Rothenberg and Gonzalez Political Report. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones and take your calls. 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about down-ballot races for the House, the Senate, and whether Donald Trump's candidacy is going to be a problem for some of those. Do Democrats have a chance of winning back the Senate or even the House? With me in the studio, Stu Rothenberg, Matea Gold, Josh Krashar, and we're taking your calls and questions. Let's go to the phones and talk to Dan. He's calling us from Salisbury, Maryland. Hi, Dan.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
So I was just curious if there is any sort of data on down-ballot races for, you know, Green Party candidates or Libertarian candidates. I know because of the heightened interest in Jill Stein and Gary Johnson this year, getting a larger percentage than maybe usual in the presidential election, if that's translated to the smaller ballot, to the down-ballot races.
Hey, Dan, what about yourself? Are you going to vote for a third-party candidate?
Yeah, I always vote for third-party candidate. If you remember Jimmy McMillan, I used to live in New York. I voted for him for mayor, so I generally vote third-party.
And why do you always vote third-party?
I want more voices to be in the conversation. I feel like having a choice between two voices only is ridiculous, and that the more options we have, the more chance we have at a discussion versus I'm for this or I'm against this, and it's a stupid way to be. I think everything should be, there's a lot of shades of gray. Everything's not black and white.
Hey, Dan, thanks very much for your call. So third-party candidates, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, do they have an effect on the ballot? What do you think, Stu?
Two answers. One is, of course, the pollsters are always include them on to find out where a particular House or Senate race is. I can't think of any race where a Libertarian candidate or a Green Party candidate right now is making a big splash.
The exception might be Utah, right?
Oh, well, that's right. Evan McMullen, yeah, who is neither a Green Party or a Libertarian Party. Utah's obviously an aberrant case, a very unusual case, a conservative Republican state where, for a variety of issues, Trump's vulgarity and Trump's criticism of minorities, they've been looking for an alternative. So there's a case. You're absolutely right, a case where not one of the two major third-party candidates but an independent candidate could matter, is mattering. It's also true, Susan, that I have a piece in today's Post looking at Gary Johnson and Jill Stein and noting that while they will do much better than they did 4 years ago, both of them were their party's nominees 4 years ago, and Gary Johnson got just under 1% of the vote and Jill Stein got just above a third of a percent of the vote, that they're going to do much better than that. I still think this turns out to be a really failure for them, because given the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities, the problems of the two candidates at the top of the ticket, if Gary Johnson turned out to be a decent candidate, if he knew where Aleppo was, if he could have named one foreign leader he admired, if he didn't sound like he was baked half of the time, he should have been in a position to outperform what he's doing now. And Jill Stein the same way. Her big problem is, you got now a Democratic Party. Sure, you got a corporatist Democrat, Hillary Clinton. I can understand why progressive Democrats would not be enthusiastic about her. But this is also a Democratic Party now of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown. So it's hard. The future isn't great for the Greens either. So while I understand Dan's values and his vote intent, and it's perfectly reasonable, I think that these third parties actually had a golden opportunity this time, and it seems to have been frittered away.
And you'll know better than I, Stu, but I believe that the share of the vote that the third-party candidates have been getting in the polls has actually been eroding over the last several weeks and months.
That's right. If you look back, Gary Johnson was getting 10 and 12% in some polls early on. There was even hope that he would get 15%, or he hoped, that, and his supporters hoped he'd get 15% in the debates. Not being in the debates is a big deal. But you're right. So now he's down to anywhere from, I don't know, 3 to 7 in the surveys. And Jill Stein has dropped off only a couple points, but she was never above 5 or 6.
You know, we have a lot of emails and tweets asking us about the Koch brothers. Here's a tweet from Sylvia. She says, the GOP's outside money game is strong. The Koch brothers are putting in $20 million plus. It is imperative Hillary Clinton do her own fundraising for Get Out the Vote. And an email from Diane, who writes us from Cleveland, she says, Where are the Koch brothers? Don't they usually swoop in with their money to save down-ballot Republicans? Mateo, do they?
So this has been a very different approach taken by the Koch network this year. They actually are putting far less money into television ads. They have spent the last several years building up a permanent ground operation. They have hundreds of staffers across 35, 36 states, and they're using them to try to mobilize voters through door knocking, mailers, phone calls. It's much less sexy than, you know, a blitz of expensive television ads. They feel like it's a better investment of their money, but it has led to sort of an absence on the airwaves of what Republicans usually have seen the last several cycles, which is a very well-funded arsenal of ads coming in at the last minute from that network.
At the end of the day, will there have been more money spent on campaigns this year than ever before? Is it going to be less?
On the presidential side, I think a little bit less, because Trump has just not spent the amount of money you usually see for a presidential nominee on presidential campaign ads. But on the Senate side, the House side, you're continuing to see extremely high levels of money being spent. It's like a nuclear, you know, trying to keep up with the Joneses. Each party is spending a lot of money. You got to catch up to keep up.
We have a swing voter, I think, from North Carolina on the line. Oscar, he's calling us from Durham. Hi, Oscar.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Yeah, I just like to mention that I don't think Donald Trump represents the moderate Republicans. And I've been a registered Republican since the age I could vote. And my wife and I are both Republicans, and we both voted for Hillary Clinton. And any Republican who supported Trump, we also voted against him. So we basically decided to vote for Hillary Clinton and also for anyone that could help her out to actually make things happen in government.
And who did you vote for in your Senate race then?
Ross.
So she's the Democrat. Were there some Republicans you voted for because they had opposed Trump?
I would have, but there were none.
And Oscar, you say you and your wife are registered Republicans. You voted Democratic this year. Will that stick, or in 4 years will you be back to voting pretty much for the GOP?
It depends on how Hillary does. If Hillary, look, what I want in the government, I consider myself a moderate Republican. And all I want is the government to do their job. You know, we pay their salaries. We want them to go to government and do their job, not postpone selecting a Supreme Court justice. I mean, that's just ridiculous. You know, it's like it is in the Constitution, the president, the sitting president, selects the Supreme Court judge. Let him select the Supreme Court judge. You know, if we start sending people just to make up their own minds from there and just decide when they're going to do something and when they're not going to do something, then they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing for us, the citizens of the country.
Oscar, just one last question. Have you ever voted for a Democrat for president before?
No.
So, Oscar, thanks so much for your call. You know, Josh, this is the Republican's worst nightmare, is Oscar, right? He's been a solid Republican. He's never voted for a Democrat before. He voted basically a Democratic ballot this time, and he says what he does in 4 years depends on what happens.
This really has the potential to be a realigning election of sorts, in that college-educated white voters have, throughout the whole century, essentially, voted for Republican candidates, usually by significant margins. Mitt Romney won by about 12 points in the exit polls over Obama, even though he lost the election. Donald Trump is trailing by about 12 points on average in the national polls among that demographic group that it sounds like Oscar or a lot of voters like him are a part of. Trump is trying to run up the score with blue-collar white voters, and in North Carolina, there's sort of these cross currents where you have rural voters in the state that are maybe used to vote Democrat are moving in the Trump column, but there are a lot more voters in the suburbs and in the populated areas around Raleigh, Charlotte, and across the country, and that's why Trump is really facing such long odds in this election.
Mateo.
And what Oscar articulated, I think, is also a really bad sign for the Republicans who are trying to make the case that you need to elect our candidates to be a check on Hillary Clinton. There are a lot of Americans who do not like the gridlock in Washington. So I do not know if that argument is actually going to resonate that much with people this year who now just feel like the system's broken. We want to get something done. So, you know, if they do like her policies, if they're going to vote for her, it seems like that argument is not going to resonate.
Stu.
Yes, thank you, Susan. I'm not surprised by this call at all. In fact, I wrote about this many months ago again. The argument has been, well, Mitt Romney won white voters by 20 points, 59 to 39. The argument has been there are still these hundreds of thousands of white voters out there who don't participate. They've been frustrated with the political system, distrustful of our leaders, don't feel that government is responsive. And now Donald Trump, the guy who's coming in on the white horse to save the world, the universe, the planet, he's going to bring them out. And I always thought, well, maybe, yes, there are some white voters who don't vote, but most of those people are so disconnected from the political system that even Donald Trump won't bring them in. But I always thought, okay, let's concede that there are some more white voters who vote Republican. But how is Donald Trump going to do among Latinos compared to Mitt Romney? 18 to 29-year-olds compared to Mitt Romney. College-educated voters, self-described pragmatists or moderates like Oscar. It just never added up to me when you looked at the various elements of the Republican coalition. And I think Oscar is not alone. And I think Oscar is an example of why Donald Trump is going to do worse among white voters than Mitt Romney did.
Well, if that's the case, and all these structural factors and demographic factors favor Hillary Clinton, why was the race pretty close, at least until pretty recently?
I have to challenge your premise. I think that right after coming out of the Democratic convention was about a 10-point race. I think it closed to about a 5-point race. I don't think it ever got closer than that. I know some people said it was even. I don't think so. I think it was a 5-point race. If you look at the NBC News, Wall Street Journal, that tend to be in the mid-single digits. And now it popped open some more.
Well, Hillary Clinton is and was a deeply disliked candidate herself. I mean, if you had a more generic Democrat running against Trump with his even at his high point in this race, he probably would be losing by more significant margins. But a lot of people were trying to pick the candidate they like a little bit more, but even though they don't like either candidate.
Here's a tweet from Jason. He says, "Why do you guys always talk about the Koch brothers and never talk about the long collaboration between Clinton and George Soros?" Matea, what's the role that George Soros has been playing this year?
I actually wrote a big story about the role that Soros and other billionaire liberals have been playing on behalf of Clinton and the Democrats earlier this week. Check it out. But the main point is that she tapped into this base of wealthy supporters very, very early on this cycle. And they have given tens of millions of dollars to a super PAC supporting her. And Priorities USA Action, which is the main super PAC running ad on Clinton's behalf, has now raised more money than any super PAC in history. And if you had predicted that a Democrat would have had that super PAC, I think all of us would have been surprised.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have a tweet, an email, I guess, from Deb, and I don't know what the facts of this are, so I'll give it to our panel. Deb says the guests need to correct something they said about Evan Bayh running for the Senate in Indiana. She says that Bayh has $10 million in his coffers, not 15 to 20, and all polls show he is 5 points ahead. Can somebody address that?
So it's in that $10 million. I mean, he had a lot more money than any senator out of the Senate has had in quite some time, and that was why he decided to jump back in, because he did have this financial advantage. And as far as the polls, Indiana is one of those Senate races where Republicans and Democrats privately disagree on where the race stands right now. But one reason Bayh has a slight edge in the public polls is that he's a better known candidate. People know Evan Bayh.
His family has been in Democratic politics in Indiana for what, 60 years?
His father, governor, he was governor. So there's a slight disadvantage that the Republican Todd Young has when it comes to name identification, when it comes to getting his own name out there.
You know, we had a Republican in North Carolina, Oscar, called saying he was voting for Clinton. Now we've got a Democrat from Vermont saying she's voting for Trump. Patty, hi.
Hi there.
So tell us what you're doing.
I'm voting for Trump. I've gone Republican this year because I can't stand Hillary Clinton. And I was disillusioned by Bernie Sanders. I like what Trump stands for. I want to change. But I do have one thing to say. The way everybody's bailed out on him, all those Republicans, in 4 years, whoever wins this time, in 4 years, I will not vote Republican for any of them. I don't know what I'll do, but all my friends feel the same way. I have a lot of women friends. They've changed from Democrat to Republican for Donald Trump.
All right, Patty, thank you so much for your call. Patty was calling us from Westminster, Vermont. Now, Patty has gone in one direction, but the fact is a lot of women voters have gone in the other direction. It's where Hillary Clinton has her big advantage among women voters, Matea.
Yes, and the Trump campaign is trying to eat into that by emphasizing the past marital indiscretions by former President Bill Clinton. They have a very overt strategy from the candidate on down to make a case that Hillary Clinton is not good for women, and going right to the heart of her relationship with her husband and how she treated women who accused him of various allegations. And that's because they know that this is her big ace card. I mean, I don't know, Stu, have we ever seen such an imbalance in terms of the woman?
It's really remarkable now, isn't it? It's as if we have a male party and a female party, and it's probably not healthy. And it has some of this has to do simply with the quality of the candidates, their unique assets and liabilities, and also the fact Hillary Clinton will be the first woman president. After that, that may be once that happens, if that happens, assuming it happens, it's probably going to happen. I don't know. Voters may look at that a little differently. It won't be this defining event for many people.
You know, I'd like to ask each of you to tell us about one race where you think there's going to be an upset, a race where the conventional wisdom is that one candidate is going to win, but you think there's a good chance the other one will win. Josh, let's start with you. What is your upset?
So I'll go to the House for this one. And Daryl Issa is in a very, very tough race in California. He's in a district. He's a guy who hasn't had to worry about his reelection. And that's a big warning sign. The members who lose are in a surprise type of race are usually the ones that just aren't prepared for their campaign. And this is a district that Issa represents. It's getting a little more Democratic and a little more Hispanic. It's in the suburbs in Southern California. So I would not be surprised at all if Daryl Issa, one of Obama's biggest thorns from his time in House leadership, ends up losing on election night.
Matea, give us an upset.
Well, based on where the money is being spent, I don't know that this would be a huge surprise, but I think Kander is likely to take Missouri. If you see how much.
Yeah, he's running for the Senate.
For the Senate.
Yes.
One of the things that really seemed to catch fire was this ad that he did in which he was blindfolded and assembling and disassembling a gun and talking about his support for actually restrictions on access to weapons, and also making the point that he is obviously knows what he's talking about and uses firearms. And so that's a race I think the Republicans are worried about.
So that put him kind of against the Democratic conventional position on guns. It reminded me a little of Jody Ernst's ad in Iowa where she was castrating pigs. I guess maybe these are stunt ads that have worked for some candidates. Okay, Stu, you're last up.
By the way, I was talking to a Republican insider last night about that race, and he agrees with Mateo, or Mateo agrees with him. He agrees with Mateo that Roy Blunt is an underdog that's probably going to go down. I'll give you an obscure House race. I'm going to request Josh to correct my missing details on this. But I think it's Florida 18, and it's Republican Brian Mast is going to upset Randy Perkins, a wealthy Democratic businessman.
All right. So you'll have to come back on the air after the race, after the election, and tell us how you did with these predictions. I want to thank our panel for being here with us. Stu Rothenberg, Matea Gold, Josh Kroshauer, thanks so much for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Baker, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Danielle Knight, Erica R. Hendry, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewenskus.